Hello and welcome to Sense in Numbers, a podcast created and hosted by two people who have varying levels of experience in mental health issues. We are not mental health professionals, we just want to create a format for people to listen, share and find support in. Each episode will concentrate on different aspects of mental health illness, treatment and experience.
We also feel it pertinent to deliver a trigger warning due to the subject matter of the podcast. You may hear some distressing details and stories. There will also be some mature language and possibly my squeaky crying voice. So listener discretion is advised.
Gemma's got a pea head, a pea head, a pea head. Gemma's got a pea head and the headphones look massive.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Sense in Numbers podcast. My name is Benjamin Franklin.
And I am the artist formerly known as Angry Gemma.
Why are you no longer angry?
It's a lie, I am, still.
You just lied to the public.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, welcome back. Back on the horse.
You're talking to them again, aren't you? Yeah. We've been through this before. Like, I've been here the whole time.
Basically say thank you to those that are returning after the Chuckle Fest, the non-stop laugh riot that was episode 3.
Yeah.
It was heavy like a Sontag Morgan, that one was.
It's been a while. We feel that we should offer some form of apology for how long it has been, especially after altering the last one because there was a lockdown going on. But it was very heavy for us, as indeed, I'm sure you'll appreciate. And we needed a bit of time to just recuperate and come back fighting, as it were.
Yeah. And the thing about that episode, as uncomfortable as it may have been for some people to listen to and distressing and upsetting as it was for us to record, I do believe it was important. I still stand by the fact that it's vital that people see the struggles that you go through being by my side. Not just, you know, give you some, just put guilt coupons on my plate or make people pity you, but just, you know, it's good to get a rounded idea of what struggling with mental health is like in a marriage or a couple or a family.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was necessary. And the feedback we got ranged from, that was hilarious, please do this every week, to...
No one said that about that story.
But there was some really genuinely helpful feedback. Most of it was centered around how it helped people to understand what going through that is like for the person suffering and for the person supporting them, and that's what we're here for.
And a lot about crying.
Yeah,
a lot. Sorry, yeah, about that.
No apologize. We don't apologize. We do warn everyone every episode.
Yeah.
And you weren't that squeaky either.
Wasn't I?
No,
I blocked it out,
which leads me to believe that you were putting it on. I jest.
You're a dick.
I am. Shall we share with the folks what has been happening in the 6 months that we've been away?
Such a drama queen. Not that much, really. Yeah. We've had a couple of birthdays. I mean, no, just the regular one,
yeah,
each.
Yeah, the standard one each.
So, yeah, our original introduction is now null and void. As you would expect with yet another lockdown and it being winter, I've had a bigger caseload, I suppose I would say, of people struggling with mental health issues I've been helping in the background.
Yeah.
And you've been doing another podcast.
I have.
But, cheating on me.
Yeah, I know. I have, but that's just part and parcel of the staying occupied requirements of my condition.
For the first time on this episode, we have a super special guest joining us. We're hoping to do this every other episode going forward. And so we've toyed with the format a little bit. The preposterous past procedure will be truncated. And we've decided to omit the "that's not true, mate" element.
You have to say...
No, I'm not doing the voice. Kind of you do the voice spice, and then I'll carry on.
Oh, that's not true, mate.
Yeah, that bit. We've decided to omit that this episode because our wonderful guest does some myth busting of her own.
Let's get going. Now it's time for, I think, my favourite feature of our podcast, preposterous past procedures. And this episode, Gemma's bringing the sauce. You're bringing the meat, aren't you?
I'm bringing something. It's neither of those things.
She guarantees that it's got some relevance to mental health.
Mine always do.
Yeah.
Right. You will definitely have heard of this term.
Oh, that's risky.
You probably won't have related it to treatment for mental health issues. And I know that there's at least one term in here that's going to make you laugh, which is what I love hearing. So
okay.
Hydrotherapy.
Ah, yes.
What is hydrotherapy?
From what I know, hydrotherapy is the use of like water environments to make people relax. It's not, I know, not torture. Like,
are you talking about waterboarding?
Yeah, that's not a form of hydrotherapy.
Why are you even linking those two in your? Anyway, yeah, no, it's not.
Okay.
That, wow, that escalated quickly. Hydrotherapy. I chanced upon this on that beautiful website, mentalfloss.com, again, and I love how they phrase their articles or whatever they're called.
Is it kind of less scientific-y and more...
Scientific-y?
Yeah, and more accessible, more informal.
I guess, yeah, yeah. And they begin. If the word hydrotherapy conjures up images of Hollywood stars lazily soaking in rich scented baths, which is kind of along the lines of what I think you were getting at,
yeah,
then you probably weren't an early 20th century psychiatric patient. I mean, to be honest, if you were an early 20th century psychiatric patient, you'd be really, really old right now and probably don't remember your name, never mind anything else. However, they were building off the idea that a dip in the water is often calming, but psychiatrists decided to use liquid treatments to treat mental health conditions. For example, hyperactive patients would get warm, tiring baths. I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
Lethargic patients. I don't know whether, would that be depression if a mental health issue causes lethargy?
Well,
it might have been one of the things that went with syphilis, which again, I know we talk about this an alarming amount, but they would receive stimulating sprays
of
water. As you know, obviously you know, and most of the people listening to this will know, I've got fibromyalgia, which is a chronic pain and fatigue condition. And one of the best things that you can do for fibromyalgia is to do low impact exercise in a warm environment. And one of the things that's suggested is a heated swimming pool, as long as you can dry off properly afterwards and all the rest of it, before coming out into the normal English weather that re-cripples you instantly. So when you think of being submerged in warm water because you are hyperactive or whatever, you think, oh, that, you know, that could potentially work. But the way Mental Floss described it was a little bit too delicate for what I found elsewhere.
Okay.
And there's another site called CVLT Nation. charlievictorlimatango.com, and this is what I think you'll like. A treatment for mental illness in the 17th and 18th centuries was called the Bath of Surprise.
I'm intrigued.
what would surprise you if you got, I mean, anything other than water, I suppose, unless you were doing comic relief and it was a bath of beans. But what would be like really surprising?
A bath full of marmots, crabs, anything pinchy, a bath full of other people.
Other people.
A bath full of Lego.
Okay, stop.
Bath of surprise.
The idea was like a kind of dunk tank that you would see on game shows. And it's just the words. An agitated, mentally ill patient would be dropped into it without warning.
But, and can I just clarify, we are laughing at the terminology
used. The wording, not what they did. That's grim. It's horrific. I imagine if...
You're already agitated. They're like, come here, John.
And but they do then add an effective but deranged way of sedating patients.
No shit. Was this next to the toilet of ridicule? Underneath the shower of suspense.
It was deemed so effective, they claim, that it evolved into hydrotherapy. So this was a form of obviously treating with water, but I don't think it was referred to as hydrotherapy at the time. It's more an early 20th century.
Okay.
It's more an early 20th century treatment known as hydrotherapy. But the way these describe it is a practice of continuous baths, mummifying a patient in wet cloth or spraying them with water. And this continued late into the 20th century. With a continuous bath, the patient was strapped into the tub and a canvas sheet covering the bath left just their head poking out.
Hold up. I've got some things to ask. Is there anything worse than wet cloth on your body?
It makes me very uncomfortable just to think about it.
Can I get physically recoil when I touch a towel that's wet that I've just dried my body with. It's the sensation. Or if you drop a tea towel in a sink.
I have a complete meltdown. I wish I was exaggerating. I cannot stand it. If you're washing up and water goes up your sleeves, I can't deal with that at all. Just wet cloth touching my body. No, thank you.
Or like hot streams of piss running down your leg as you're walking through a town on the way to the pub.
I think that's a different kind of, at least it's warm anyway. Hot so piss. Yeah, you're strapped into the tub with your head poking out and a sheet over.
So strapped in as in like strapped, restrained?
Yeah, restrained in the bath. And it could last for several hours. Or several days.
Jesus Christ, you'd prune up like a MFA.
And was this is interesting though, it was most often used. Huh?
What about wheeze and poos?
That's the only time you would be allowed out was to go to the toilet.
You just run.
Well, and it was most often used as a treatment for insomnia or depression and suicidal thought.
I'm not too sure that would help me, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. I mean, how's that going to help you sleep apart from when you get out of there, just pretending to sleep for the rest of your life because you don't want to be put back in a bath for 6 days.
You'd be super clean, super, super clean.
Really also, wrinkly.
You'd be, and what's that word when your muscles go and you can't walk?
Oh, atrophy.
Yeah, you'd have atrophy of the muscles.
Not after a few days.
Oh, I think you would. They're not going to be putting you in nice, like a bubble bath, are they? It's going to be hard, dirty, like skin soup after a while.
It doesn't matter. That's not going to affect muscle atrophy.
I don't know either. What muscle atrophy is.
Stop talking about stuff you don't know anything about, Ben. And the final one we're going to talk about, because we are keeping it brief, apparently,
is still brief, though.
The most brutal of the hydrotherapy treatments, where while they were compared to showers, looked more like a hosing down, where the patient would stand in a shower-like stall, sometimes strapped in, and they would have a hose of water sprayed at them. They would have water sprayed at them from a hose, usually cold but sometimes hot, for several minutes at a time. And I like, this is a great sentence. While shorter than the other hydrotherapy methods, this one seems the most traumatising and humiliating. What are we trying to do here?
I would say so. And isn't it a case of like a self-fulfilling prophecy? If you are locking people down and hosing them down violently, afterwards they're still going to react, aren't they? There is still going to be some kickback after that. If you're putting them in baths for days, hours, there's still going to be kickback after that. So you're always kind of going to experience that behaviour.
It's probably why they don't do it anymore. That's why it's preposterous.
It is. It's quite alarming.
It is, but it's not how, I mean, as far as we know, isn't happening now.
Just imagine your head just poking out of a bath but covered in tarpaulin.
And also just watch yourself, because you know, if you get too crazy, I'll have to drop you into a bath of surprise.
Bath of surprise. Excellent. That I like that, because that was punchy, it was succinct. I didn't know anything about that. I knew what hydrotherapy was, but I didn't know.
Yeah, it's contemporary form.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're so Gemma. Welcome.
And now it's time to introduce our first guest. Her name is Mrs. Jessie J. Money Roberts. She will be the first member of our new section called
Get Your Dicks Out.
Now, just to clarify, we do have quite a large military following, and Gemma didn't say tits, she said dits, D-I-T-S. Now, what's a dit? Look it up, actually. You do some work. Look it up on Google or military Google, whatever.
Moogle.
Right, listeners, you're in for a treat. We have a very special guest today who is a close friend of both Gemma's and mine. She's joined us today to share her views on mental health, her own experiences, and being blatantly awesome. Isn't that right, Jesse?
You know, I do try.
So would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Okay, where do we start even? Okay. Hi, I'm Jesse. I'm American. I am a mother of a 2-year-old little boy and a wife of a 3-year-old little boy. Just kidding. I've been living in the UK for 4 years this year, actually, which is crazy because it really doesn't seem that long at all. But I guess you can not count last year, so technically 3.
So you've been here for 4 years and experienced one summer.
Yeah. And then I was told it doesn't snow, but it snowed all last week. And then I feel like it's just been snow. So yeah, I am mentally hilarious.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a little bit about me. I guess I was diagnosed with bipolar 2 in February of last year. So actually kind of at my 1-year anniversary, if you will. Is that the right word to use?
Anniversary, celebration, another year of making it, whatever you, whatever you deem necessary. First question, straight out of the bat.
Sure.
You've been here for 4 years. What would you say is the overall difference between the treatment and reaction to mental health in this country compared to where you're from?
Ooh. So I think they're two very separate categories, right? Because I didn't really take the time to be assessed or get help or therapy when I was in the States. I was of the mindset that I had a very transient issue at that time. So I thought it was just anxiety or just depression. It was actually, weirdly enough, my gynecologist who prescribed me Xanax. Yeah, not related to lady problems. But yeah, I just told him I was feeling really anxious. I was in a really toxic relationship at the time and couldn't sleep, couldn't, you know, just had that kind of heart palpitating anxiety. And so he prescribed me Xanax and it was nice.
What is Xanax?
I'd have to look up the exact kind of PAM it is, but I would probably compare it to like a lorazepam, not a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, nothing that had long-term effects. It's an opioid, really. I mean, it's a very addictive medication, can go wrong very, very quickly. Really, I took it to go to sleep and it would put you in this kind of cloud of, you can't function, you can't drive, you can't work when you take it. So it is not really a solution. It's just kind of a Band-Aid. It's a plaster.
Yeah.
I think when I was there as well 4 years ago, you know, the conversation about mental health and stuff has just really opened up since I've been here. And I'm not sure if that's a cultural difference or if it's a sign of the times or what have you. But they do seem to be a lot more switched on in the UK in terms of talking about mental health awareness. It's a lot more acceptable to speak out here than it is where I'm from. But I'm also from the deep south of the United States. Right. So
I was just going to say, I think there's a distinction to be drawn because obviously America is a huge place. North America in itself is a huge place. And attitudes can change wildly from state to state, never mind one end of the country to the other. So,
oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
There's definitely a lot of states that are more progressive than others. And there are different parts of Florida that are more progressive than others. But where I'm from tends to be a little bit more backwoods, a little bit more closed mouth, if you will. But here, I think it's easier to get medication in the United States, which is can be a good or bad thing, depending on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. But I feel like here, you know, because of the NHS and because of all these things that are available to you, it's easier to get other kinds of help. Proper diagnosis may be more difficult in this country because you're not necessarily paying for private, you know,
consultation. Care. Yeah.
Yeah. So I will say though, the reason I got diagnosed and even went to the doctor in the first place about it was because of my health visitor after I had my son.
Yeah.
And we don't have health visitors in the States. So the fact that you have these people whose job it is to check up on not only babies and children, but moms and dads as well, that played a really big part in me getting help. That's all the UK, really. I feel very fortunate.
I think sometimes it can go amiss in this country when we complain about GP appointment waiting times or hospital appointment waiting times. We're so, so lucky to have that support and that.
Mm.
We really are. And a big shout out to our postnatal services because they are amongst the best in the world.
Incredible.
That leads me on to my next question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, I know nothing about postnatal depression. Well, I know nothing generally.
Yeah.
But I know even less about postnatal depression and the effects it can have on people's mental health.
Both men and women, mothers and fathers or whichever partner can get postnatal depression.
Yeah.
Really?
That's one of the things that I found out going through antenatal classes actually is they check up on the dad just as much as they check up on the mom. So they check up on the partner that hasn't given birth just as much as they check up on the one that has, because the likelihood of postnatal depression is almost the same.
Is it the physical trauma and emotional trauma you go through during childbirth? Do you reckon that's a lot to do with the after effects?
I almost don't think it has anything to do with it.
Okay.
I think it's a bit more scientific than that. I think in the person that births a child, in the mother's position, you've got the trauma of birth. You've got that your life has just changed drastically. But also, your brain is changing chemically when you're pregnant. It's been scientifically proven that your brain changes when you are pregnant. And so you've got, think of it, you're pregnant, you've got a person inside of you that's producing their own hormones on top of your hormones. So you've got extra of what you had before. And then all of a sudden, that life is not inside you anymore, and that's gone. So it's such a drastic change inside your body. And I think some people's brains never chemically
readjust,
repair.
Yeah.
Not never, but sometimes they have a blip, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
there are people who are clinically depressed before getting pregnant that don't experience postnatal depression. A lot of the time, most of the time, there are people who have never experienced depression that suffer the worst with postnatal depression. So it's really one of these things that, you know, and I think on the non-birthing side of things, the other partner is dealing with the changes, dealing with having to watch their partner go through these changes. It's almost a mourning for a previous life, if you will. As bad as that sounds, you're happy to have this child, but you're mourning like your
previous version. Yeah. How do you feel your mental health encroaches on your parenting, if it does?
You know, I do feel that there are times when I feel low that because I have a 2-year-old and he's so high energy, I have to convince myself to kind of get up and go.
Yeah.
He's also quite sensitive to, like, if I'm sad or if I even pretend to cry, he comes over and takes my hands off my face and gives me a big hug and puts on a sad face until he sees me smile again. So there is always that kind of like hidden pressure, you know, yeah, to be happy so that your child sees that. But it's a double-edged sword, I think, because I don't want him to grow up thinking that being happy all the time is realistic. I don't want to put my problems on him because that's not his burden to bear, if you will. But I also want him to be a realist, and I don't want him to think ever that if he's sad or he doesn't feel happy, that something's not right with him, that it's normal to have this full spectrum of emotion. You've got, as a parent, any kind of caregiver responsible for another human, you've got this built-in guilt, regardless of mental illness, regardless of anything. I mean, every decision you make, there's so much conflicting information about milestones, where your children should be at, how you should be parenting. Should you be breastfeeding? Should you not be breastfeeding? Should you be using cloth nappies or regular nappies? Or, you know, should you put your kid in front of the TV or not in front of the TV? Or, I mean, there's so much conflicting information. So you're constantly feeling guilty if you try to discipline your child, which a 2-year-old child is like trying to baptize a cat. It's not a thing, at least for mine anyway. Like, if you even say, I'm gonna smack you on the bottom, which I never even have, or you say no, he just looks at you and he's like, ha! He doesn't care. But I mean, if you even do get a little stern with them or make them cry, there's so much guilt involved in that, because you want to keep this little person happy and loved and whatever, but then add mental illness on top of that, where you've already got guilt ingrained in your system.
We've got extra guilt coupons.
Remember that thing I said 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm a piece of shit. I should probably die.
On that note, the guilt thing, how far back do you go? Because I can. This is why it's been 11 years since me and Jem got together, and only very recently has she kind of told me that she understands why I need noise. Because before, I just need distraction. When she explained to me, my thought processes go from very, very much like, you know, how old are my feet? To, oh my God, when I was 12, I got an answer wrong in science and everyone thought I was an animal rapist. And then I'll go through that process. I will lie awake. And then that will lead on to one thing, onto another. And then before I know it, I've been awake for 6 hours. My next day is ruined. I just want to know, is that a process that you also...
I will describe it to you in the thought I had before we did this podcast, because it has triggered some negative emotions in me. Okay. And by negative, I mean, when I was 5, I'm not joking. I might have even been 4, you know, because I was in preschool. I went to a preschool called Care-A-Lot. Okay. And I will never forget it because of this incident. I was sassy then. I am sassy now. The daughter of my preschool teacher was in my class. Now, she was a little bit older. She thought her shit didn't stink. And I was a very sassy four-year-old. She had one of these expensive art kits, you know, with like the cool crayons, not like the normal Crayola ones, but like the posh ones. She left to go eat lunch or something, and the rest of the kids were napping, and I got up and I went in her thing and I broke all her crayons. That's not even the worst part. It's not the worst part, okay? I'm a terrible human. And I was four. I'm going to cry in a minute. When we all got up, she was so mad. She was stomping about and she was like, oh, who broke my crayons? And I literally pointed to the kid next to me and I said, he did it. And he got blamed. He got punished. It was bad. I also ended up going to school with this kid until I graduated high school. We were in every grade together. Not only that, if I was four then, I'm very bad at maths. It must have been about 12 or 13 years after that, that I went to a dance recital of one of my friends and this girl was there. And I turned around to her at the beginning of it with my eyes full of tears. And I said, I am so sorry. I have to tell you this. You probably don't even remember who I am, but it was me.
Did you remember?
Yeah. So that makes it even worse because you're like, I lay awake at night thinking about how I broke this girl's crayons. And I don't really care about her crayons as much as I care about the kid I blamed it on.
Yeah.
You know, having to mentally suffer, because of me. But yeah, I obviously caused her some mental anguish because she still remembered 12 or 13 years later that some little asshole and all of her expensive crayons. So anyway, that's an example of describing to you my type of guilt. It does go back as far as I can remember to any kind of interaction with anybody. I mean, even in situations like my first marriage, which was an incredibly toxic and incredibly abusive, where sometimes I go back and justify his behavior in my head, which to an outsider, his behavior is repulsive and disgusting. But to me, if I'm feeling very low and I'm having one of these nights where I just lay in bed and I replay the past 30 years of my life, how could I have done this better? Why am I such a piece of crap? I'll sit there and I'll think, oh, well, maybe it's because I'm crazy or I do this, 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 and this, that he did this, 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 and this.
Yeah. So essentially you're convincing yourself that you're the reason for his mm-hmm. behavior, yeah. Which itself in itself is, unfortunately, that's the mentality of somebody who wasn't treated as well as they should have been. I don't use the word victim or abuse victim,
right?
Because that's a very loaded term. But as far as I've read, that's exactly what people yeah. feel when they come out of an abusive relationship. I remind myself of all the negative things that have happened to kind of ground myself to make sure that I don't get carried away with being.
If good things are happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. And I don't know that's something you also do, but I am.
He doesn't feel worthy when good things are happening. So things like his own graduation, which he didn't want to go to. And I really had to twist your arm to get you to go to. And this was your second degree. And you're to the
know you had two degrees.
Well, yeah, neither did his dad that day, and that's not a cuss on on Niggy Pop, but he went, oh, my son the graduate. I went, he's already got a degree in Orange. And it's just because he made such little fuss about it because yeah. he hated his first university with a passion and was very, very depressed when he was there, and it took him a long time to get through it. Not in a not academically, you know, he just struggled, and then I came along and was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Shocker.
Not as long as it took you to drive, Ben.
what it went piling on me for? Fair enough. It took me a while to drive.
Don't drive here, so I can't really say anything.
Again,
yeah, you can drive in the US, can't you?
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
But you also hid the fact that you were doing your driving test from me. And had you failed, I never would have known. You could have done three attempts before that, and I would have no idea, because you are, you know, you just don't think that you deserve any praise for anything and want to keep it as low key. You did it when I was away for the weekend.
Yep.
So I couldn't even really make a fuss. Yeah.
So it was a surprise.
Well, yeah.
I don't deal with positivity, like people being positive, not a problem. People mm-hmm. having positive outlooks, absolutely grand.
Yeah.
I cannot deal with any positivity towards me, and it makes me feel uncomfortable, mm-hmm. almost to the point it makes me feel quite angry.
So then I feel like, oh, what can I fuck up now? What can I do to kind of counterbalance that positivity? Oh, right. I'll do something stupid, or I'll say something stupid, or I'll be rude or mean to somebody. And that's basically what I've done. Jen's been the brunt of that, or felt the brunt of that for a while.
You say that like it's a conscious decision, though, and I think we've covered this before, but I really don't think it is. It's the back of your mind somewhere. You just don't think you deserve any congratulations or positive vibes from anybody for anything. So you just begin a process of self-destruction, and those things are symptoms of that.
Do you think that that's a bit of like imposter syndrome?
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I might have to make up a name for this syndrome. Let's call it Keith syndrome, because I can't think of anyone else's name. Feeling you get when somebody is quite clearly talking about someone else, talking about their bad behavior and their shitty attitude, and you kind of convince yourself that you're that person as well. So, for example, if you and Gemma are having a conversation and you were talking about your ex and Gemma was talking about her ex, and you were both like, yeah, and you did this and you did that, I'd be like, I could convince myself that I also do those horrors. Yeah. So that's Keith syndrome. Boom.
Uh-huh. 100%.
Give me another name then Keith.
Comparison syndrome. Comparison.
Osmosis.
Osmosis.
Negative osmosis.
No.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So do you do that, Jesse?
Yeah. Yeah, I think mine is more, I deal with a lot of paranoia, and I don't know if that's quite the same, but it's similar. You know, I always think if I see two people speaking in a low voice that they're talking about me. I think that every time my husband's on the phone, he's texting another woman, you know, that if my mom is talking to my brother on the phone, that they're talking shit about me. Or I think I just automatically feel like an outsider all the time. I always have felt like I've been outside looking in.
Yeah.
Not that I've ever been included, but to be fair, I've not really tried either. I'm not, like I say, I've got better friends in the UK than I ever had in the US, with the exception of like my longest best friend, Amber, that I've had since I was 14. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's because since I moved to the UK, I've been kind of healthier mentally. I've had time to heal and time to work on things and find medication that works for me and do all these things to just take care of myself that I wasn't doing when I was there. So I don't know if I'm just in a better headspace, but even with the good friends that I have now, you know, like I'd think, oh, Gemma and Ben are having wine with somebody else tonight. I wonder how much shit they're talking about me later.
Normally it's like, how can we get Jesse involved in this?
It's like, you know, it's just one of those things. I think at work, I'm very opinionated. I'm quite a competent, efficient person when it comes to work. I like to work hard. That is the one thing that can distract me from what's going on in my head. I've always loved to be busy. But like last week, I was only in work for an hour because nursery was closed and all this stuff. But the hour I did go in was from 6 a.m. to 7 a.m.
Yeah.
I went in and like made an inventory list of all the stuff with the coffee and the syrups, and not my job, but I just did it because it needed to be done. And I left it on the manager's desk. And all I could think about for the rest of the day was, oh my God, I'm going to get fired because I don't know what boundaries are. And I don't know how to stay in my lane.
That's just you. You're essentially utilizing your drive to make things easier for other folk because you have that. And yeah, some people will be like, well, thanks, but no thanks. But then it's, you're only doing it to simplify things, to make things easier.
But I just am a chronic overthinker. So there is a lot of paranoia. I do find myself, even in my marriage, I mean, I am very blessed to be married to the man that I am. He is understanding. He never makes me feel bad. He tries to educate himself and other people, you know, about mental illness and the things that we go through and whatever. But there are nights that I lay awake and think, God, when he leaves me for his receptionist in 4 years, what am I going to take? Where am I going to take Henry? How does that work legally? And then I'll Google, does he have to sign papers for me to take him or is it kidnapping? You know, you just go down this rabbit hole of negativity, and there's so much paranoia involved in it. So
I can empathize. 100%.
I don't even know if I just answered the question, because now I'm thinking about, did I speak too much or did I answer his original question?
It does not matter. We are sharing.
aren't we, Gemma?
Absolutely, and it's all beneficial for both of you. Cool. Say whatever's on your mind.
Next question.
Ask me some hard ones, Ben.
Okay.
Don't make a joke about hard ones.
I did set you up for it. She's like, very disappointed in you.
She's like, American, and then like, hey, governor, you want me to get you some fish and chips? It's brilliant.
Uncanny.
Me? Yeah. You really think that's how I sound?
You're perfectly American for ages, and then you'll just say something, and it's just brilliant. But like Cockney, which makes no sense because nobody, I don't know if you're particularly close to any Cockneys, but obviously none of us are.
I am. My friend Becky from Chicksands, she's from London. And also the guy I worked with in Grantham when I first moved here, he was Cockney, Nigel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I was in My Fair Lady once.
You were?
Yeah, but I wasn't Eliza Doolittle. I was like a wench in the background.
Cockney win.
Come on, hit me with the hard one.
What's your feelings towards medication? Mine is slightly different to most people's because I've been doing it for a lot longer. But what's your feeling towards it?
Well, I used to be quite averse to the idea of being medicated, mostly because I don't think I ever really researched it that much. All I was used to seeing in the States was Prozac commercials and things that just seemed like they were for crazy people, not for me. Yeah. I wasn't crazy. Xanax is a joke in the US, you know, like everything's, I'm just going to have a glass of wine and a Xanax. But Xanax makes you feel like someone's just killed your puppy every morning when you wake up after you've taken it. It's serious. The side effects are serious. But I didn't feel medicated when I was taking that because it wasn't something that had a permanent or like long-term effect on the chemicals in my brain. But now that I'm on it, it pisses me off, right? I'm going to be completely honest with you. It pisses me off because it has made so much difference in my life. I just want to punch myself in the fucking face. Can I say the F word?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, go for it.
Okay. I just want to punch myself in the face because had I been open to this idea 10 years ago, and I know we go through everything for a reason and there's no real use in, you know, revisiting all of that, but that's how my brain works. I wish there was less of a stigma. I wish that there was more education. I wish that there was more focus on getting people the appropriate help and the appropriate assessment to see what they need and then giving them all the options as if the options were equal, not as though being unmedicated is better than being medicated or vice versa, whatever. Because being medicated has changed my life for the better. Honestly, I've never felt better. I still have low moments, but nowhere near what I had before.
That last bit you said about giving people the options and educating them is so spot on, so spot on. Because if you do give people that information and you allow them to make a decision, an informed decision, and you let them know that, it won't cure you, it won't take it away, and you're not going to be skipping through the ether with Jesus on this, and this will get rid of it straight away. If you just educate people and give them the choice, it's so beneficial. But going back to your other point as well, it's frustrating because you've started taking it and it's had a great effect. But I think you have to go through the mire. You have to go through the bullshit to truly appreciate, you know, what not only what you've achieved, but what you're made of. And the medication thing is it's a tough one to roll with. Because I know that.
Well, go ahead.
No, go. Because I was just going to bumble on.
I just an interrupter. It's okay. I'll cry about it later.
and in 10 years.
Yep. My philosophical bit is, as much as I get frustrated with me from 10 years ago, who was very, I won't say ignorant, but ignorant, I feel like having to go through what I went through for the past 10 years led me to a place where I was open to take medication and where, because I do think there's something to be said for people who are ready to take medication, people who understand that, you know, serotonin reuptake inhibitors aren't, there's not a change the day after you start taking them for the first time. There's this period where things get worse before they get better. I was just in a place where I was ready for that change. And had I been presented with that 10 years ago, I might not have been. Mm-hmm. But I genuinely believed what other word starts with gen? Anyway, I
genocide.
Thanks. yeah, straight to the morbid one. Genuine, the rapper. I really thought that if I started to take a long-term medication, that it would change me as a person. Because another really hard truth is that with bipolar, you know, and I am like queen of rapid cycling. Okay. I'm like an every 5 minutes kind of human. Either that, or I can go from being really neutral to just completely different. It takes no time at all for me. No rhyme or reason, no nothing, just something switches in my head. And a lot of people have this issue with mania. I don't say issue. They have this feeling about mania like I do, where I actually feel sometimes when I'm manic, like I'm my best self.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, God, people think I'm hilarious when I'm manic. I'm funny. I have energy. I'm motivated. I want to start like 8 businesses and I want to clean my house and I'm fucking awesome and I can do anything and I'm the best mom. And then 2 seconds later, some water spills on the floor and I'm like, oh my God, I am a worthless piece of crap. I'm the world's worst mother. I'm a terrible wife. Jamie should leave me right now because I'm just way too much to handle. Maybe I should just leave him because I don't want to wait until he stoops his receptionist in 20 years. I just want to get out now. You know, so that's literally how easy that switches for me. And I thought that being medicated would take the best parts of me away.
Yeah.
But what it has actually done has allowed me to be my best self for longer. A calmer version of it, a more rational version of my best self. And when I do have those moments where the switch flips, instead of delving into that deep, dark pit of self-loathing, I can almost talk myself around it. Instead of absorbing the problem, I'm watching it from the outside.
Yeah.
And I'm deciding how I can react, which is something I've never been able to do. Ever. Yeah, I can't say anything bad about it. I think I got very lucky that I'm on the correct dosage. If it's something that's recommended and something that you can be educated about, then do it. Research it, decide if it's the right thing for you. And then I just think there's nothing wrong with it. If you have a headache, you take a paracetamol. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I can't add anything. You've put it eloquently and beautifully.
Please tell me if I need to shut up.
I've only known you like 4 years, but I feel a kinship with you, not just because you're a good person and you're a good friend and you're funny. I've always felt that in those small windows that we've spent time together, you very similar to Jem, I can just be myself. And whether that's a depressed Ben or a maniacal Ben, which 9 times out of 10 people do get that version, but they think that's me, but I can just be myself, whatever version I am that day, I can be myself, and I'm fully accepted by you. One of the things that I felt was necessary for you to share is the thing at the moment in this country is there's a huge concentration on men's mental health, and you know, 1 in 4 men, and the statistic keeps getting more stark as the days go by. It's important that we have these friendships and these discussions and these relationships that allow us to be that version of ourselves, regardless of how we're feeling. Regardless if it scares us, if that person you do that in front of trusts you and you trust them, they'll understand. You did from the very first day I met you. And it's almost like a silent kind of just a nod. I know she knows. And then you like, I know he knows that I'm mental. And I'm
like, I know that. We know.
And it immediately put me at ease. And I'm not saying that I don't feel comfortable with people who aren't mentally hilarious like us do, but it's such a huge help when people understand. That's why I love my wife as much as I do, because not only does she understand, but she stands back when it's necessary, she stands up when it's necessary. But it's so important for people to just accept that's you, and you've always done that, so thank you very much.
Thank you. I think it's important to offer a safe space to people, and I didn't know you, and you picked me up to take me to the hospital because I broke my ankle, and we'd met.
I think we met twice before. Once was we had like a
Christmas do.
Yeah, we had a hootenanny at your place, didn't we? Was that?
Oh yeah, the first night I got here actually.
And then a Christmas do, the one of the worst Christmas do's I've ever been to in my existence.
Where you guys sat across from us, didn't you?
Yeah, and
or you didn't sit near us.
It was shit.
By the door,
yeah,
that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I drove you to the hospital, and then I begged you not to tell Gemma that I drove all the way to the hospital with a handbrake on.
And I didn't tell her because I don't know what that means. So
it's the same as driving with the parking brake on, basically.
Oh, like the e-brake is what we call it. Emergency brake.
I drove all the way through Lincoln. But thank you for not telling her. I've told her.
Yeah, so. Anytime.
I can't deal with
you. Did yourself in there. So. but I do think it's not that I did it intentionally. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to sit in the car and I'm going to provide Ben with a safe space to tell me he's nuts. But I think it was maybe because I didn't know you that well, and because you seemed so easy to talk to, and you seemed like an open person. And I think I was probably at that point, because I just moved here and that was the lowest I've ever been. I was desperate. I was desperate for an ear. I was desperate for a kindred spirit. And sometimes you just recognize them, you know. And when I was in the car, something came over me and I was like, oh, word vomit, like I'm doing a podcast, you know. By opening up and by being transparent about your own struggles, even if your own struggles don't compare to the person next to you, that is a gateway for somebody else to walk through and say, okay, like, this is a safe space. We can talk here. And for me, it's never been about male, female, whatever, because, you know, I have a husband that doesn't like to talk about his emotions. He's quite a strong person. And I used to think something was wrong with him. Like, maybe he was more mentally hilarious than me because he doesn't like to talk about what's going on in his head. But actually, in truth, he just rationally sorts things out, because I find myself constantly like, are you okay? What's going on? How's your day? How are we feeling? What's in your head? What are you thinking? Because we automatically, as mentally hilarious people, think that other people have the same brain activity that we do, and they don't.
No, you don't.
So yeah, there will be small times when he says something like, oh, work was really hard today, where I do try to take that time to encourage him to tell me more about it. Or like, I'm really proud of you for telling me work was hard today, because that's something you never do.
Here's a cup of gravy.
Here's a biscuit. but yeah, I like to feel like people can talk to me, because I have kept my mouth shut about nothing else besides my mental illness for almost 30 years. And I was not really free until I moved here and met you. And I do credit you and credit Gemma with a lot of my progress, if you will. because it's the first time I ever sat in a car with somebody, especially someone of the opposite sex, and said, wow, I can talk. Someone knows how I feel. This is weird. Normally I feel like a nut job, but I didn't feel alone. So transparency with your own thoughts and creating a safe space for other people, that's the key.
Is it a line from Alice in Wonderland, we're all mad here? It's like, she came here and was like, oh, I fit right in.
I am terrible at quoting literature. So I have a sign on the door that I'm actually looking at right now that says, we're all crazy here. apparently, I'm not posh enough to use the word mad.
Is there a song that you listen to that either encapsulates your mental health struggles or provides you with buoyancy?
Okay. I can think of one that encapsulates my mental health struggle, and it's Hole in the World by the Eagles.
Oh, okay.
They wrote it September 11th. They were actually in the studio when the Twin Towers fell on September 11th, and they wrote it. It says, there's a hole in the world tonight. There's a hole in the world tomorrow. There's a hole in the world tonight. I think I just fucked this up. Hold on.
That's a great lyric.
Oh, there's a hole in the world tonight. There's a cloud of fear and sorrow. There's a hole in the world tonight. Don't let there be a hole in the world tomorrow.
Oh.
And I think because not just personal events affect me so much, but I do find myself so affected by world events and just things that are going on. I feel I'm very overwhelmed. When I manic, I want to change the world, and then I get low because I can't. And then you feel small, and then you feel smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And so does anything I say, or does me being a good person even matter? Does it because nothing I'm going to do is going to change anything. So that song for me encapsulates, like, it's a hopelessness, but a hopefulness at the same time. How about for you?
Yeah, there is one for me, but it's a bit of a strange one.
Pour some sugar on me.
Yeah, it is. Pour some sugar. You know, I think that's
that
a
would
song
be
about...
my song if I was a stripper. I'm just saying, and I've always thought that. Please tell me what song helps your mental health.
Well, it doesn't help my mental health per se. What it does, it encapsulates the struggle beautifully, quite terrifyingly actually. And it's a song by Jamie Lemon called "Memory."
All alone in the moonlight. That's from Cats, by the way. No, I just want everyone to know that's not my real singing voice, and I will go to bed later thinking about how everyone thinks I'm a terrible singer because that's how I sang.
Oh, it was stunning.
But also, we can edit that out.
We won't know.
It's fine.
My song is a song by Jamie Lemon called "Muscle," and it details the relationship between him and the person that's helping him, and he talks about how. He has to go to this place and he's sorry. The person can't go with him. He'll be back. He doesn't know when, but he'll always be back until the day he's not. And it sounds really grim, but it's driven by this aggression. And in the aggression, you can hear a genuine desire to want to change, to want to not come back. You know what I mean? And it just, every time I hear it, it kind of boils my kippers and it makes me want to kind of fight a little bit.
What that reminds me of? And I was talking to someone the other day about something they were going through, and I said, actually learned this in a skincare seminar that I went to when I was traveling for a company, and they said that there are no scars, only muscles.
Interesting.
Which I really loved, which is kind of ties into your song, but the whole premise behind that was, if we look at our trauma and our past as muscles rather than scars, we think of them as something that makes us stronger, not something that we always have to be constantly reminded of, something we use to make us strong. That's an interesting kind of
analogy
thing.
It's been awesome. It has been incredible.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Because it's obviously it's something that you and I discuss most of the time, but to come onto a podcast and talk about it.
But mostly when we're drunk and we're crying.
Yeah. Or you're teaching me how to line dance.
Have I done that?
Yeah, you remember that? In our kitchen in Cranwell.
I fucking know.
And you got.
Was it a Cotton Eye Joe?
You got pissed off at me because you said I had the coordination of a potato.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
It's all right. But yes, thank you so much for your time, your words. You put things so eloquently. You are a wordsmith.
This was about a year after I moved to the UK, and I was feeling quite alone, not just being away from family and friends back home, but my husband, Jamie, was working all the time, and I was in this tiny little village, quite idyllic, honestly, and every day I would go on a walk and I would go to the co-op and I would go to all these little houses in the village that sold fresh produce and things. And I just found such joy in that most of the time. And there was a day where I just woke up feeling the lowest I'd ever felt. And I remember sitting in the garden, just like miserable. And I wanted nothing to do with being there. Didn't matter how good my husband was to me, didn't matter how much of a family I had back home that I knew that loved me and I knew that missed me as much as I missed them. It was just, I didn't want to deal with anything anymore. I didn't want to think anymore. I was sick of thinking. I was sick of laying up in bed in the middle of the night thinking, and I just wanted to shut my brain off. And the only way I could think was to shut my brain off, was to not be here anymore. And I was sitting in the garden and I just had a thought pop into my head because I was looking at the different plants and the different flowers that were in the garden. And so I just took my phone out and this is what I wrote down. I wanted to die today, but I bought flowers instead. I contemplated life this morning as I lay in my bed. I wondered, as I often do, what's wrong with my head? Why can't I keep it quiet? Why is it so mean? Am I really this terrible at life? Why are my thoughts so obscene? I constantly need reassurance from the people that I love. I no longer have the endurance to stay quiet and rise above. So often I'd rather be alone than bother anyone with the truth. The world is a cruel and evil place. What I'd give to have back my youth. When I look in the mirror, there isn't a thing I wouldn't change, but I smile at everyone regardless because they all like me better that way. So I went to sit in the garden to try and talk myself down. I know these thoughts will go away, but they always come back around. It made me think about flowers and the cycles they go through, how even though they wilt, they always come back and bloom. The earth doesn't reject them because they go away for a little while, and the sun welcomes them with a smile. But maybe my life is the same as theirs. Maybe the journey isn't something to dread. I wanted to die today, but I bought flowers instead.
Right, there you go. Episode 4. In the bag, in the can, in the cupboard, ready to go. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, we apologise for such a long break, but go on the internet and moan if you don't like it. We hope that the break between this episode and the next won't be as long as last time. Gemma, anything to add?
No.
Excellent.